The Lord's doing great and mighty things in California, and I'm just excited to introduce the next speaker. He's a giant of a man, and you'll understand in a second what I mean by that. Dr. Monteith has been instrumental in educating and informing all of us on a very critical issue. He is a respected orthopedic surgeon. He has had many, many years in medicine, but he has become well known for his work in addressing the AIDS epidemic. For many years, his medical career, he has led a delegation of physicians from Santa Cruz County to the California Medical Association's House of Delegates. There he fought to convince the medical community that AIDS should be addressed not as a medical issue, as a medical issue and not as a civil rights issue. Dr. Monteith wrote a book about his efforts to bring reason and rationality to the AIDS debate. He entitled that book, the controversial book, AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic. He now publishes a national newsletter known as HIV Watch, which keeps readers abreast of what's happening in the world of HIV and AIDS. I was on his Radio Liberty program. He is monumental in doing what CWA does best, and that's educating and informing people. Help me welcome Dr. Stanley Monteith.
Well, thank you very much, Veronica. It's a privilege to be here with you today. Of course, the last speech was a very happy, funny speech. My speech is not necessarily funny, but it's serious, and it's a speech that hopefully will give you information that you perhaps have not had in the past. Now, to give you an idea of what I'm about to say, I'd like to tell you a story that was written 400 years before Christ was born in Bethlehem. It was written by a Greek philosopher who was trying to explain what was going on in Greece as the glory that was Greece was beginning to fade and the society was beginning to crumble. It was an allegory. It was the story of a group of men and women who had been taken captive and been taken into a large cavern, where for many years they were kept in chains. Chains so that their walls were towards the face of the cave. Their backs were towards the center of the cavern where they burned in eternal fire. And all the many years that they were in their chains, all they could see was the wall of the cave and the dancing shadows projected upon that wall by the fire in the center of the room. Now, at times their captors would make shadows with their hands, and those shadows projected upon the wall of the cave would be sometimes funny, humorous shadows, and the people would laugh. And other times, those shadows would be terrifying figures, and the people would cry out in terror, because you see, their reality were simply dancing shadows projected upon the wall of the cave. And then one day, one of their group broke loose from his chains and went outside and saw reality. He saw the sun and the stars, the brooks and the trees. He saw life as it really was. And he went back in and he broke his fellows loose from their chains and tried to lead them out of the cave. But as they approached the mouth of the cave, the light blinded their eyes, and they turned back. Because you see, for too long, their reality had simply been dancing shadows on the wall of the cave. Now, that story was written by Plato, and you'll find it in the Republic. And he was explaining that people's mind were conditioned by the information that they were getting that was faulty. And I would like to suggest that just as what Plato wrote 400 years before Christ was born in Bethlehem, 2,400 years ago, is as true today as it was then. For much of the reality of the American public is simply those dancing shadows projected upon the wall of the cave upon the reality of their mind. It was William James who said, it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is, if repeated often enough, people will believe. Adolf Hitler said, you know, people will believe a big lie more than a small lie. And he also said, by the clever and constant use of propaganda, we can convince those who live in paradise they live in hell, or just the opposite, we can convince those who live under the most absurd of circumstances that they live in paradise. And the tragedy is most of what the people of America believe today just is not true. Now, to give you an example, most of you have heard of the World Trade Center bombing that occurred several years ago. But how many of you ever heard the story that appeared in the New York Times, October 28, 1993, as I remember? Anyway, we prepared a bibliography here because much of what I tell you may sound a little absurd, and so I want you to know where you can get the information. But what really happened in the World Trade Center bombing was that there was a man named Mr. Salem, who was actually the FBI informant working within the terrorist group. And his job was to build the bomb. And so he was going to build a bomb that would not go off, and they were going to park it down in the basement of the World Trade Center, and then they were going to arrest the terrorists for wanting to bomb the Trade Center. But at the last minute, the Federal Bureau of Investigation told Mr. Salem to build a bomb that would go off. Well, he didn't want to do that, and they insisted that he was under orders, so he taped all of the interviews with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And he taped them not only before the bomb went off and killed six people, did billions of dollars of damage and injured 1,000, he taped them afterwards. And he kept saying to the FBI, why did you insist that I build a bomb that would go off and kill all those people? And they said, it's not our problem, we were just ordered to do it. And how many of you remember when that hit the newspapers? It was in the New York Times one time and then totally blacked out. So we never heard it again because you see our reality are simply those dancing shadows projected upon the wall of a cave. But if you want the article, we have it. Now, how many of you remember when last year 1 million Christians were slaughtered in Africa? 1 million Christians were simply hacked to death as something was known as the final solution. It was between April and July of 1994 when 1 million Christians in Rwanda were systematically slaughtered. And hardly a word in the American press until after it had happened, and then it was never mentioned that they were Christians, because Rwanda was primarily a Christian country. And then it was always, well, perhaps 500,000, or if you read the New York Times, a few hundred thousand. And it wasn't simply these people were shot. They were actually hacked to death to create a situation of terror in Rwanda. But, of course, the media didn't cover that, because, you see, had we thought that 1 million Christians might be being slaughtered last year, somebody might have spoken out. But when did you hear anybody in the Christian community speaking out against this horror? Because, you see, we didn't even know that they were Christians. But if you'd like to get the very verification, it's all there in the biography. So much of our reality are simply dancing shadows on the wall of a cave. We live in a wonderful utopian society here in America, unparalleled in all history. We live a comfortable life. But you know, this has been the bloodiest century in all history. And throughout the world, there's been terrible suffering. Starting at the turn of the century with the Boer War, 150,000 casualties. And simply 12 years after the end of the Boer War came the First World War. There were 50 million casualties. 22 million people died and the rest injured. 50 million casualties. Those become statistics because that's really beyond the comprehension of the average individual. And following the First World War came the Russian Revolution. 60 million people systematically eradicated. Those are the figures that come from Solzhenitsyn and from other sources. And for those of you who want the verification, we have the bibliography that you can get the information. But you see, we don't talk about that in America because, after all, the Russians are good people. They're our friends now. Why, we're giving them money. We're supporting Yeltsin. But where's the cry for the prosecution of the war criminals who committed so many of the atrocities? And then, of course, came the Second World War. Adolf Hitler eliminated about 15 million people, of which 5 to 6 million were Jewish, and the rest were Christians and gypsies and political opponents, members of the workers of the various labor movements there. But we never talk about that. All we ever talk about is the 6 million Jews who were tragically eliminated. As a result of the Second World War, there were somewhere between 60 and 70 million casualties. And then after the Second World War, China went communist, and the Chinese communists, who are, of course, now are good communists, we understand that because we give them most favored nation treaty status, they eliminated somewhere between 40 and 80 million people. These are statistics because it's difficult to understand that every one of those is a human being. And since the Second World War, we've seen Afghanistan, and we've seen Mozambique and Angola, and we've seen what happened in Uganda, where Idi Amin, who incidentally now is living in Saudi Arabia that we support, killed 250,000 people in Uganda. The story of what's happened in Africa, in fact, even today in the Sudan, Christians are being slaughtered and starved and sold into slavery. About 1.5 million Christians in the southern part of the Sudan have been killed. We've seen the wars in Ethiopia. We've seen the wars all over Africa, Cambodia, certainly Vietnam, Korea. We could go on and on. But the millions, the countless millions of people who've died. One of the great tragedies, of course, is because we're so concerned about the environment, we've outlawed DDT, which is probably one of the safest insecticides ever known to man, and as a result, 3 million people die every year unnecessarily throughout the world of malaria. About 100 million people have died in the last 30 years since we did away with one of the safest of all insecticides. Of course, now we have abortion. It's estimated that worldwide perhaps 500,000,000 people have died. We have an epidemic of AIDS, and of course you're not getting the truth about AIDS in America. 280,000 Americans have already died, another 200,000 in terminal stage disease, 1 million or more are affected just waiting to die, and we're not trying to stop the epidemic. But we're lucky in America, because we have a type of the virus that's much less pathogenic or much less easily communicable than that they have in Africa. In Africa, if you go into Malawi, and a friend of mine just came back from there, 30% of high school students are infected. In the urban areas where we're passing out condoms. Now, in the tribal areas where they're not passing out condoms, there's almost no HIV disease. But in the areas where we are passing out condoms, 30% of the high school students and about 60% of those in the agricultural college are now infected. Same figures you'll find in Botswana, you'll find them in Rhodesia, some places in Uganda, 80% of the population are infected. In India, this same gentleman, his name is John Harris, he used to work with Josh McDowell, but in India, the public health authorities have contacted him and told him they're anticipating by the turn of the century 10,000 people a day will be dying of this epidemic. And you know how we're fighting the epidemic? We're telling the people, go ahead and be promiscuous, just go ahead and use a condom. In fact, if you read the Washington Times within the last 2 weeks, a Peace Corps officer, I happen to be a personal friend of mine, Dr. Ricker Porlsdorfer, was fired from the Peace Corps because he said, working in Rhodesia, now called Zimbabwe, that we ought to be pushing abstinence rather than condoms, and he didn't think it was safe for Peace Corps officials and employees to be having sex with the indigenous population. So they fired him. This is the madness that's going on in the world today. Well, how do you explain this sort of madness? Well, I'd like to tell you four poems that I think really tell the whole story. The first one was written in the 1850s by James Russell Lowell. It's called This Present Crisis. And this is what he wrote, talking about the moral crisis of slavery that faced America in those days. Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide. And that strife of truth with falsehood for the good or evil side. It is then the brave man chooses while the coward stands aside until the multitudes make virtue of the faith they have denied. Though the cause of evil prospers, yet his truth alone is strong, though a portion be the scaffold and upon the throne be wrong. But that scaffold sways the future, for in the dim unknown standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch upon his own. And James Russell Lowell was talking about a strife of truth with falsehood and of evil being on the throne, but that God is still there, the ultimate mediator of what's going on in the world. The second poem was The Dream, that captured the mind and the imagination of the people of England at the turn of the century. It was written by Tennyson probably in the 1880s. For I dipped into the future far as any eye could see, saw a vision of the world and all the wonder that would be, heard the heavens filled with shouting and the rain the ghastly dew of the nation's airy navies grappling in the central blue, till the war drums throbbed no longer and the battle flags were furled in the parliament of man, the federation of the world. What a wonderful dream. Parliament of man, the federation of the world. where there'd no longer be wars. That was the dream. That was what captured the imagination of a generation of the youth of England. And then, of course, the reality of that generation, that dream, was written by Lieutenant Colonel John McRae, who was a Canadian surgeon who went to France to take care of the tragic victims of the First World War. And this is what he wrote. In Flanders field, the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the lark still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amidst the guns below. We are the dead. Scarce days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders field. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch, be yours to hold it high. If you break faith with us to die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders field. And of course, if you analyze what he said, he talked about take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw. Who was the foe? At the end of the First World War, nobody could really understand the war. It didn't make sense. 50 million casualties. Now, to explain the war, we don't have the time. We could take the whole time we have just to explain the intricacies of the war. But it never made sense. It never made sense to the Kaiser, who was supposedly responsible for the war. In his memoirs, he said, I think it was a secret Masonic conspiracy. There were other ideas. It was the bankers, because bankers made money during the war. Well, it was the munitions manufacturers, because the munitions manufacturers made money. It was the commercial interests. Not only why did the war start, but why did they perpetuate it for 4 long years? At the end of the war, there'd been a revolution in Russia, and the Russian government had been destroyed, and it was replaced by a communist government that killed 60 million people. There was a revolution in Germany, there was a revolution in Italy, there was a revolution in Turkey, there was a revolution in Hungary. And Europe was never going to be the same again. It just didn't make sense. Well, it didn't make sense because most people don't understand what's really going on behind the scenes, because your reality are simply those dancing shadows that have been projected upon the mind, on the wall of your cave, or the wall of the mind of your reality. We owe a debt to President Clinton. We really do. Because he has given a certain notoriety to his teacher at Georgetown University, just not too far from here. And in his acceptance speech, when William Jefferson Clinton accepted the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States, he said this, and as a teenager, I heard John Kennedy's call or summons to citizenship. And then as a student at George University, I heard that call clarified by a professor named Carol Quigley. Now, Bill Clinton is given the first inaugural Carol Quigley lecture at Georgetown Foreign Service School. He gave that in November of last year. And he's mentioned his professor, the man who really was his mentor at Georgetown on a number of occasions. Who was Professor Carol Quigley? And you really can't understand much of what's going on in the world today unless you understand who Carol Quigley was. He was a liberal college professor who in the mid-1940s, shortly after the end of the Second World War, met a man named Sir Alfred Zimmern. And Sir Alfred Zimmern had been part of a secret society. And he told Professor Quigley all about it, and Professor Quigley spent the next 20 years writing about that secret society and its influence on England and its subsequent influence on the United States of America. He wrote the first book, Anglo-American Establishment, and even though Professor Quigley was well known, nobody would publish the book. It was only published after his death. In 1967, about the time Bill Clinton was at Georgetown, he wrote a second book. It was called Tragedy and Hope, The History of the World in Our Time. 1,348 pages long. It's a real undertaking to read this book. The book was so good that the publisher destroyed the plates to the first half of the book so it couldn't be republished, because the American people were not to know what was in the book. Now, if you think that sounds pretty far out, by serendipity, I just happened to come into possession of a taped interview with a professor where he tells the story. I found it in his papers at Georgetown, and I was one of the first people ever to go through his papers after his death, and I bought rights to that tape from his wife, and we have circulated that tape across the country. Why would a publishing house like Macmillan destroy the plates through the first half of a book that was selling well and there were demands for all across the world? Very simply, because your reality is to be kept as dancing shadows upon the wall of the cave. Well, let me tell you what Professor Quigley wrote about. He told the story of a secret society that had been created, and he went into the background of that secret society and how it all came about. Now, it really started with the ideas that came about at the time of the Enlightenment, when man decided that they could get by without God, and there were many byproducts of that move. There was Rousseau, and one of the disciples of Rousseau was a man named John Ruskin. He was a professor at Oxford University. And professors have a profound impact on the minds of their students. Now, John Ruskin, and if you go back and you read the Encyclopedia Britannica written in 1913, before it was so carefully censored, you'll find that John Ruskin was a self-avowed socialist and communist and internationalist, and he wanted a new world order, and he was really quite crazy. But that really didn't matter because he had a profound impact on the minds of his students. And in 1870, 125 years ago, he delivered his inaugural lecture, and this is what he said to the students, many of whom would be the leaders of England at the turn of the century, at the time of the Boer War and the First World War. "There is a destiny now possible to us, the highest ever set before a nation, to be accepted or refused. We still are undegenerate as a race mingled of the best northern blood. We are not yet dissolute in temper, but still have the firmness to govern and the grace to obey. We've been taught a religion of pure mercy, which we must either now betray or learn to defend by fulfilling. And we are rich in the inheritance of honor, bequeathed to us through 1,000 years of noble history, which it should be our daily thirst to increase with splendid avarice, so that Englishmen, if it be a sin to covet honor, should be the most offending soul alive. And this is what England must do or perish. She must found colonies as fast and as far as she was able, formed of her most energetic and worthiest men." And so the dream was England was to dominate the world. And sitting in the audience that day was a young man who was so taken with the words that he heard from Professor Ruskin that he wrote them down and carried them with him the rest of his life. And that young man set out to carry out a dream. And he moved to Africa, and he gained control of the diamonds and gold mines of South Africa. 7 years after Ruskin gave his inaugural lecture, Cecil John Rhodes, for whom the Rhodes Scholarships are named. And the Rhodes Scholars in the White House today are William Jefferson Clinton, Stephanopoulos, Ira Magaziner, Robert Rice, our new Supreme Court Justice, Stephen Breyer. Cecil John Rhodes wrote his plan. It was the Confession of Faith. He wrote the first of his 7 wills, in which he called for the formation of a secret society. Incredible. Oh, we don't have secret societies. They couldn't exist today. I mean, if it was secret, why, Dan Rather would tell us. I mean, Barbara Walters would tell us. Well, this is all, and if you want to get the documentation, I've spent 27 years accumulating this material, and so we'll be glad to give you the bibliography so you can follow the same trail, because we don't have 27 years, ladies and gentlemen. In fact, time is running out for freedom in America today. But anyway, he called for the formation of a secret society patterned after the Jesuits or after the Masons. There was to be a general of that secret society, which was, of course, to be Cecil Rhodes. The whole idea was that there was a 100-year plan to take over the world. He knew he wouldn't be around to see it fulfilled, but this was his dream. In fact, inscribed in his memorial in Africa, written by Rudyard Kipling, are these words: "The immense and brooding spirit still shall quicken and control. Living he was the land, but dead his soul shall be her soul." To quicken is to come back to life. To quicken is to come back from the dead. Cecil Rhodes' influence is still here. It's right here in Washington, D.C., operating through a number of organizations dedicated to his dream of the new world order. The first will basically laid out a plan. First of all, England was to come to colonize the entire world. America was to be brought back into union with England, or America would take up the leadership of this whole movement. It really didn't matter as long as we moved towards the new government. There would be a parliament of the empire. In other words, all the nations would be gathered together into some sort of a world government, similar to the United Nations. And then, of course, the formation of so great a power that henceforth wars would become impossible and for the betterment of mankind. What he was talking about was world government, world socialism under a ruling elite. That's exactly what he wanted. And he set out about to bring that about. Now, by the close to the turn of the century, these ideas had come to America and had been taken over fairly well by a man named Andrew Carnegie, who was to find the great foundations, the Carnegie International Endowment for Peace, which incidentally has been instrumental in creating wars, because that's how you bring about peace, is you change society. And if you find that difficult, this book is one of the most thoroughly suppressed books. We reprinted it, but it is available here. On page 204, you'll find out this is the committee investigation, the Rees Committee, commissioned by the 83rd Congress to investigate the great foundations. And what the Rees Committee found when they investigated the great foundations on page 204 was that the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. What a beautiful name. Beautiful name. What did they do? Why, they spent their money during the First World War to propagandize America to get us into the war to bring about world peace, because you had to change the world, and wars are a very effective means of doing it. Incredible stories. But of course, Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw and Barbara Walters and John Chancellor are not going to tell you these things. And so it was that Andrew Carnegie began to propagate these ideas in America. In fact, in 1894, he wrote a book called Triumphant Democracy, in which he said, the Parliament of Man and the Federation of the World has already been written about by the poet. But soon America and England will draw together in this movement towards world government. In essence, this is what he said. And so it was that the movement began to spread to America, this idea of man creating a perfect society and man creating a world government. In fact, as a byproduct of the Rees Committee investigation of the great foundations, the director of research, a man named Norman Dodd, was actually given the permission, or given the mandate from the various, from the committee itself, headed by Congressman Rees, to contact the various foundations to find out really what they were doing. And I have a taped interview, which I did in 1980 with Norman Dodd, which we also have available. Norman Dodd actually contacted the head of the Carnegie Foundation, an international Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and that was a man named Joseph Johnson. This was in the 1950s, and asked him if they would simply answer a number of questions about the motivation behind the Carnegie Endowment, their purposes and goals. And Joseph Johnson said, look, we don't have the time to answer your questions. Why don't you have somebody from your staff come and go through the notes of the Carnegie Endowment? And so they sent Miss Catherine Casey to go through those notes of the Carnegie Endowment 2 years before it was actually incorporated here. But they were discussing at that time how you would change the world. And the question was asked, is there a more efficient means than war to change society known to mankind? And they said there really isn't. They spent a year arguing it, that they felt that war was the most efficient means of changing society. And then the question was, in 1909, how will we involve America in a war? Well, if you follow the course of what happened in England through Cecil Rhodes, first of all, he had gained this great control of wealth, and he had a dream. We're going to remake the world. In 1888, he went to Matabele Land, which lies north of South Africa. He befriended a tribal chieftain named Loganbela, and he was such good friends that this tribal chief gave Cecil Rhodes the mining rights to a large area which today is known as Rhodesia. In 1892, Cecil Rhodes sent a small army in to slaughter the Matabele to capture the land, which he did, of course, because he always professed one thing, whereas he always had a different purpose. By 1895, Cecil Rhodes was the prime minister of the Cape Province. He was going into the Transvaal and the Orange Free States, which were the Boer republics adjacent. Now, Cecil Rhodes' dream was to consolidate South Africa and then to create a line of colonies of South Africa from Cape to Cairo, over to which to build a railway, to begin to consolidate the empire as the first stepping stone towards the world government that he believed in. And so, although he professed friendship for the leaders of the Transvaal Republic, who were the Boers, who were the Afrikaans farmers, originally Dutch in origin, who ordinarily distrusted the British, Cecil Rhodes was a wonderful, charming man. But he was really planning treachery. And in 1895, as the Prime Minister of the Cape Colony, he planned a revolution in Johannesburg, shipped in arms and weapons, and then sent in a commando of 600 armed men under his good friend Dr. Jameson to create a revolution in the Transvaal Republic, because you see, revolutions as well as wars are means of changing society. The Jameson raid is well known in Afrikaner history, but is seldom ever mentioned in America because it failed, and Jameson was arrested, and Cecil Rhodes was sent back to England in disgrace. But nothing was done because of the very powerful influence of the men that he had already planted within society. Because of their control over the newspapers in London, they controlled the Times at that time. They had their people actually working on the staff of the newspapers. The close advisor to the King of England, King Edward at that time, was one of the three members of the secret society, a man named Lord Esher. By 1897, Lord Milner, who was the second member of the Junta of Three of the Secret Society, was appointed High Commissioner of South Africa, Lord Alfred Milner, one of the most important names in history, seldom ever mentioned in America today. And the third man was William Stead, who was the leading publicist of England. And, of course, they were all working at that time then to convince England that they needed to have a war with the Boers, because the Boers were such terrible people. There was no reason for the Boer War. In fact, all the histories of that time just happened to be written by members of this organization. Professor Quigley talks about this in his book, The Anglo-American Establishment, and says, you know, it's really frightening. The picture is terrifying because such power, whatever the goals of it may be directed, is too much to be entrusted safely to any group. That was too much to be trusted to the Milner Group. No country that values its safety should allow what Milner Group accomplished in Britain. That is, that a small number of men should be able to wield such power in administration. Well, they created the Boer War. In fact, the history of the Boer War was never written until Thomas Pakenham in 1979 wrote a book called The Boer War, which basically told the true story of what had happened, where Milner said, I could have negotiated a peace with Kruger, who was the head of the Transvaal, but I thought better of it and precipitated the war before it was too late. They thought it was going to be a tea-time war. After all, they were foolish Boers, and England had the mightiest army in the world. 100,000 casualties later, the war came to an end, but not because the English had won, but because they had killed off so many women and children that the Boers saw no sense in keeping the war going. They arrested the women and children, put them into concentration camps. Typhoid struck the camps, and they began dying by the tens, by the hundreds, by the thousands. Between 18 and 28,000 women and children died. And when the news of that got back to England, people were so furious that England, this great and noble nation, should be waging war against women and children, that the war came to an end. Well, the same forces were at work at the time of the First World War, and the people who precipitated the First World War were intimately associated with this organization, and time precludes our getting into too much detail, but all I can tell you is that by the middle of the war, Milner was in total control of the English government. The fact that the Round Table Group, which was his group, controlled Lloyd George. Lloyd George had a secretariat made up of six people. Four of them came from Milner's Round Table. They had a war cabinet of which Milner was one of the four members, and the four members of the staff all came from Milner and his secret society. It's all covered in tragedy and hope. And you wonder why the war continued. Well, the war had to continue. It would have been over in 1917 if they hadn't brought America into the war. And they plotted and they planned. And if any of you wonder how it happened, in 1917, Congressman Calloway put an article in the Congressional Record talking about how the people in America, headed by J.P. Morgan and Company, had actually bought up control of the editorial policies of 25 American newspapers and used that to condition the minds of the American public. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace was spending its money to propagandize America to make them believe that the Huns were cutting off the hands of little Belgian boys, cutting off the breasts of Belgian women, ravishing and raping the people of Europe. And of course, there was no truth to it at all. But after years of propaganda, the America was finally brought into the war. And of course, after the war, England was devastated. And the English leaders of this movement turned to the Americans and said, you must take control of this movement because If we're going to have world government, it's going to be up to you in America. A wonderful book written by a man who actually attended that, Confessions of a Reformer by Frederick Howell. Hard to get, but we have it. We'll tell you that, you know, the whole movement then transferred to America. And England became known as the Royal Institute for International Affairs. In America, it came to be known as the Council on Foreign Relations. Barry Goldwater, in 1979, wrote a book called With No Apologies. Let me tell you what Barry Goldwater said about this organization, which is a continuation of Cecil Rhodes' dream for world government. "I believe the Council on Foreign Relations and its ancillary elitist groups are indifferent to communism. They have no ideological answers or anchors in their pursuit of a new world order. They're prepared to deal without prejudice with a communist state, a socialist state, a democratic state, monarchy, oligarchy. It's all the same. Rear Admiral Chester Ward, who was a member of the CFR for 16 years, has written, "The most powerful clique in these elitist groups have one objective in common. They want to bring about the surrender of the sovereignty and the national independence of the United States. When we change presidents, it's understood to mean the voters are ordering a change in national policy. But since 1945, three different Republicans have occupied the White House for a period of 16 years. Four Democrats have held that most powerful post the world has to offer for a period of 17 years. But with the exception of the first 7 years of the Eisenhower administration, there's been no appreciable change in foreign or domestic policy. You want to understand what's going on? You must understand the secrets that Professor Carol Quigley told Bill Clinton, which propelled him from being a small state governor into the very center of the world power. Because you see, it's all outlined in Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope of the World in Our Time, which was so powerful that the publisher actually destroyed the plates so it could not be republished in America, so that your reality would be simply dancing shadows on the wall of the cave. Now, behind the forces that we've talked about, which have such tremendous power, and we could talk about how Adolf Hitler, most of what you think you know about Adolf Hitler simply is not true. Not that he wasn't an evil man, because he was, but actually who financed him. Do you really believe that he was created in 1933 and within 5 years he was challenging Europe and taking on the whole world? Or do you really believe that America, the mightiest nation in the world, could fight a 10-year war in South Vietnam against a country the size of the state of Mississippi and lose that war unintentionally? Not at all. If you want to understand it, it's all in the bibliography. The background of this, of course, originates at the time of the Enlightenment. And there were two ideas that came out of the Enlightenment. First of all, that we didn't need God because man would create utopia. And it would be done by two routes. There were two separate tracks. One was the socialist track, and which denied the existence of God, and the other was the occultic belief that had a parallel believing that there were other forces, gods, not God, but gods, a mystical gods that would guide man towards the new world order. Now, both the socialists and the occultists believe in the establishment of a new world order. One line went from socialism, the First and Second International, to the Third International, which was communism, to the Fourth and Fifth Socialist International. The Socialist International is one of the most important organizations in the world today, with leaders in every major country, people like Mitterrand, the Prime Minister of France, one of the leaders of the Socialist International. In almost every country, the leaders of the Socialist International have powerful forces within government. Certainly the leader of the Labour Party comes from the Socialist International in England, but we never talk about the Socialist International. Secondly, offshoot of that was the corporate socialist movement we've already talked about, Cecil Rhodes Group, which eventually came to be the invisible government of the United States. And I've been through their secret files at 5080 68th Street in New York City, and how they tie together, how they're working is beyond the time that we have, but I will tell you they believe in three things: socialism under a ruling elite, world government, and the denial of God. And then, of course, the second cultic movement started with Masonry. But in the 1870s, at the same time when John Ruskin was writing, there was another movement that originated in England. It was called the Theosophical Society, headed by Helena Petrovic Blavatsky. And that secret society, the Theosophists, was kept secret until 1975. For 100 years, Most people have no idea that it even existed, but now it's manifested in the New Age, or what is referred to as the Aquarian Conspiracy, and you can read the writings of Marilyn Ferguson, who was part of that and an organizer of it, and she will tell you who many of the people are, and they're the same people who are actually within the corporate socialist movement we've been talking about. It's all there. Their objectives and goals are world government, world socialism, and the coming New Age. But of course, all of these things are really prophetic, because it was prophesied so many years ago we would be heading towards a world government. Now, what we're basically dealing with are dark and sinister spiritual forces that are behind what's going on today. And you remember how we started telling you the poem by James Russell Lowell, who said that once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide. In that strife of truth with falsehood, for the good or evil side. It is then the brave man chooses till the coward stands aside, until the multitudes make virtue of the faith we have denied. Though the cause of evil prospers, yet his truth alone is strong. Though a lot may be the scaffold and upon the throne be wrong, but that scaffold sways the future, for in the dim unknown standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch upon his own. We were involved in a spiritual battle being fought on the political and educational and legal battlefield. And we are called by God to be involved. In Ephesians 6:13, we're told, wherefore, put ye on the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day. And that is our calling, that is our obligation, that is our goal. Thank you, and God bless you.